It has been mentioned only once in UFO literature, by James Lawrenson, director of the APRA Group, and has not, to the best of my knowledge, been the subject of subsequent investigation. Such an investigation, however, would throw light on some aspects of the UFO problem now gaining considerable publicity and causing some concern to those who follow the development of the sociological context of UFO reports. Perhaps, as Lawrenson suggests, there was a military investigation that has been kept secret. If so, secrecy on the part of the authorities, if they are really concerned with the nation's peace of mind, is not the best course, as the following review of the few well-established facts of the Irwin case, which serves as an introduction to a discussion of the problem of contact, makes clear. Late on February 28, 1959, Jerry Irwin, a Nike missile technician, was driving from Nampa, Idaho, back to his barracks at Fort Bliss, El Paso, Texas. He was returning from military leave. He had reached Cedar City, Utah, and turned southeast on Route 14 when he observed an unusual phenomenon. 6 miles after the turnoff, the landscape brightened, and a glowing object crossed the sky from right to left. Irwin stopped the car and got out. He had time to watch the object as it continued in an easterly direction until hidden from view by a ridge. The witness decided that he might have seen an airliner on fire attempting a forced landing, in which case there was no time to lose. Consequently, instead of resuming his journey, Irwin wrote a note of gone to investigate possible plane crash. Please call law enforcement officers, and placed it on the steering wheel of his car. Using shoe polish, he wrote stop on the side of his car, to make sure people would find his note, and then started out on foot. Approximately 30 minutes later, a fish and game inspector did stop. He took the note to the Cedar City Sheriff, Otto Fief, who gathered a party of volunteers and returned to the site. 90 minutes after he had sighted the strange object, Jerry Irwin was discovered unconscious and taken to the hospital. No trace of an airplane crash was found. At the hospital, Dr. Broadbent observed that Irwin's temperature and respiration were normal. He seemed merely to be asleep, but he could not be awakened. Dr. Broadbent diagnosed hysteria. Then, when Irwin did wake up, he felt fine although he was still puzzled by the object he had seen. He was also puzzled by the disappearance of his jacket. He was assured that he was not wearing it when he was found by the search party. Irwin was flown back to Fort Bliss and placed under observation at William Beaumont Army Hospital for 4 days, after which period he returned to duty. His security clearance, however, was revoked. Several days later, Irwin fainted while walking in the camp, but he recovered rapidly. Several days afterward, on Sunday, March 15, he fainted again in an El Paso street and was taken to Southwest General Hospital. There his physical condition was found similar to that observed in Cedar City. He woke up about 2 a.m. on Monday and asked, "Were there any survivors?" He was told that the date was not February 28 but March 16. Once more, he was taken to William Beaumont Hospital and placed under observation by psychiatrists. He remained there over 1 month. Lawrenson reports that, according to a Captain Valentine, the results of the tests indicated that he was normal. He was discharged on April 17. The next day, following an unidentifiable but very powerful urge, he left the fort without leave, caught a bus in El Paso, arrived in Cedar City Sunday afternoon, April 19, walked to the spot where he had seen the object, left the road, and went back through the hills, right to a bush where his jacket lay. There was a pencil in a buttonhole with a piece of paper wound tightly around it. He took the paper and burned it. Then he seemed to come out of a trance. He had to look for the road. Not understanding why he had come there, he turned himself in and thus met Sheriff Otto Fief, who gave him the details of the first incident. The Lawrensons contacted Irwin after he had returned to Fort Bliss and undergone a new psychological examination, as futile as the previous one. His case came to the attention of the Inspector General, who ordered a new examination. On July 10, Irwin returned to William Beaumont Army Hospital. On August 1st, he failed to report for duty. 1 month later, he was listed as a deserter. He was never seen again. New Hampshire revisited the Irwin cases, reminiscent of another incident that has become one of the standards of modern American folklore, the report by Betty and Barney Hill and their examination under hypnosis by Dr. Benjamin Simon, which has been documented at length by John Fuller in his excellent book, The Interrupted Journey. The reader must carry in mind the main features of the Irwin and Hill cases in order to follow the discussion that is the object of the present chapter, so those already familiar with the cases must forgive me if I repeat what is already well known to them. But in so doing, I hope some observations will come to light that have not previously been published. Report number 161, in the files of the 100th Bomb Wing, Strategic Air Command, Pease Air Force Base, New Hampshire, was prepared by Major Paul W. Henderson. The only official document concerning the Hill case, it apparently has never before been published. Yet it contains a detail of which both Dr. Simon and John Fuller were unaware. The objects seen by the Hills had been detected by military radar, during a casual conversation on 22 Sept. 1961 between Major Gardner B. Reynolds, and Captain Robert O. Doade, Commander 1917-2 PZFB, NH, it was revealed that a strange incident occurred at 0214 local on 20 September. No importance was attached to the incident at the time. Subsequent interrogation failed to bring out any information in addition to the extract of the daily report of controller. The visual sighting itself is summarized as follows. On the night of 19-20 Sept., Mr. and Mrs. Hill were traveling south on Route 3 near Lincoln, NH when they observed, through the windshield of their car, a strange object in the sky. They noticed it because of its shape and the intensity of its lighting as compared to the stars in the sky. The weather and sky was clear at the time. In the report itself, under paragraph E, location and details, we read Betty Hill's account of the sighting as reported by Pease Air Force Base officials. The observers were traveling by car in a southerly direction on Route 3 south of Lincoln, N.H., when they noticed a brightly lighted object ahead of their car at an angle of elevation of approximately 45 degrees. It appeared strange to them because of its shape and the intensity of its lights compared to the stars in the sky. Weather and sky were clear. They continued to observe the object from their moving car for a few minutes, then stopped. After stopping the car, they used binoculars at times. They report that the object was traveling north very fast. They report it changed directions rather abruptly and then beaded south. Shortly thereafter, it stopped and hovered in the air. There was no sound evident up to this time. Both observers used the binoculars at this point. While hovering, objects began to appear from the body of the object, which they describe as looking like wings which made a V-shape then extended. The wings had red lights on the tips. At this point they observed it to appear to swoop down in the general direction of their auto. The object continued to descend until it appeared to be only a matter of hundreds of feet above their car. At this point they decided to get out of that area, and fast. Mr. Hill was driving and Mrs. Hill watched the object by sticking her head out of the window. It departed in a generally northwesterly direction, but Mrs. Hill was prevented from observing its full departure by her position in the car. They report that while the object was above them after it had swooped down, they heard a series of short loud buzzes which they described as sounding like someone had dropped a tuning fork. They report that they could feel these buzzing sounds in their auto. No further visual observations were made of this object. They continued on their trip, and when they arrived in the vicinity of Ashland, NH, about 30 miles from Lincoln, they again heard the buzzing sound of the object. However, they did not sense it at this time. Mrs. Hill reported the flight pattern of the object to be erratic, changed directions rapidly, that during its flight it ascended and descended numerous times very rapidly. Its flight was described as jerky and not smooth. Mr. Hill is a civil service employee in the Boston Post Office and doesn't possess any technical or scientific training. Neither docs his wife. During a later conversation with Mr. Hill, he volunteered the observation that he did not originally intend to report this incident, but inasmuch as he and his wife did in fact see this occurrence, he decided to report it. Lai says that on looking back he feels that the whole thing is incredible and he feels somewhat foolish. He just cannot believe that such a thing could or did happen. He says, on the other hand, that they both saw what they reported and this fact gives it some degree of reality. Information contained herein was collected by means of telephone conversation between the observers and the preparing individual. The reliability of the observer cannot be judged, and while his apparent honesty and seriousness appears to be valid, it cannot be judged at this time. This report is remarkable for what it does not contain. In this respect, it is probably typical of a large class of Air Force records, most of those involving close proximity to a UFO, where either witness reluctance or lack of adequate follow-up eliminated the most significant information. In the present case, the witnesses failed to give the Air Force any information as to the beings they could see aboard the craft during their observation with binoculars. And proper investigation would have disclosed an element of which they were not immediately aware. They could not AC count for a time gap of 2 hours between the two periods of buzzing sounds. In fact, they could not recall how they had driven the 35 miles between Indian Head and Ashland so casually mentioned in the Air Force report. What happened after their story became known is well documented in John Fuller's book. Both witnesses had ascribes of strange nightmares. The dreams led them to see a psychiatrist who used hypnosis to discover the root of the problem, and it was only then found that the origin of the nightmares could be traced to those missing 2 hours. Under separate hypnosis, Betty and Barney Hill said they had been taken by the strange beings into the UFO. I have been privileged to hear the portion of the tapes covering the abduction of Betty and Barney Hill. Further discussion with the witnesses, and with Dr. Simon and John Fuller, leads me to regard the case, not as an individual event to be investigated and treated as such, but, on the contrary, as an indication of a general pattern that cannot be separated from the total phenomenon. First, it is interesting to note that, as further details came to the Hills' memories after treatment, the case took on more of the features present in other UFO landings, of which the Hills could not have heard. One such detail is the recollection by Betty Hill that, after their car was stopped and a group of men had come toward them, the creatures had opened the door of the vehicle and pointed a small device at her. When I asked her to what usual object she could compare it, she told me, it could have been a pencil. It is not necessary to repeat the descriptions given by the Hills of the manner in which they were abducted or of the conditions inside the object. It is enough to say that the statements made under hypnosis by Betty and Barney are in general agreement. And it is also useful to study the detailed accounts of the entities given by the witnesses. Betty states, most of the men are my height. None is as tall as Barney, so I would judge DM to be 5 to 5 feet 4 inches. Their chests are larger than ours, their noses were larger, longer, than the average size, although I have seen people with noses like theirs, like Jimmy Durante. Their complexions were of a grey tone, like a grey paint with a black base, their lips were of a bluish tint. Hair and eyes were very dark, possibly black. In a sense, they looked like mongoloids. This sort of round face and broad forehead, along with a certain type of coarseness. The surface of their skin seemed to be a bluish grey, but probably whiter than that. Their eyes moved, and they had pupils. Somehow, I had the feeling they were more like cat's eyes. For Barney, on the other hand, says this, the men had rather odd-shaped heads, with a large cranium, diminishing in size as it got toward the chin, and the eyes continued around to the sides of their heads, so that it appeared that they could see several degrees beyond the lateral extent of our vision. This was startling to me. The mouth was much like when you draw one horizontal line with a short perpendicular line on each end. This horizontal line would represent the lips without the muscle that we have. And it would part slightly as they made this mew mew mumming sound. The texture of the skin, as I remember it from this quick glance, was grayish, almost metallic looking. I didn't notice any hair or headgear for that matter. I didn't notice any proboscis, there just seemed to be two slits that represented the nostrils. There are some obvious contradictions between the two descriptions. Betty speaks of very dark hair, Barney did not notice any. The men described by Barney do not exactly evoke in my mind the picture of Jimmy Durante. On the other hand, the creatures are strikingly reminiscent of the UFO operators of a large number of stories unknown outside a very small group of specialists. Apart from disagreement on the nose and lips, Betty's statement matches the description made by Barney of the shape of the head and the color and appearance of the skin. Another remark by Betty is significant in this respect. I got the impression that the leader and the examiner were different from the crew members. But this is hard to say, because I really didn't want to look at the men. Two other elements are outstanding in this case. One of them is the manner of communication with the strange beings. They communicated among themselves through an audible language, which was definitely not understandable to the witnesses. Yet when they communicated with the hills, their thoughts came through in English. Betty thinks that they spoke English with an accent, while Barney feels that the words and the presence of the entity were two separate things. I did not hear an actual voice. But in my mind, I knew what he was saying. It wasn't as if he were talking to me with my eyes open, and he was sitting across the room from me. It was more as if the words were there, a part of me, and he was outside the actual creation of the words themselves. This very remarkable statement, an excellent description of the mechanism that triggered the communication, may well be a clue to the entire episode, and it certainly places the case in the domain of the theory of apparitions, as it is treated, for instance, by Tyrrell in his celebrated 1942 Myers lectures before the British Society for Psychical Research. Thus it is noteworthy that the apparent absurdity of the sequence of actions constituting the episode should be reducible to the triggering of high-level perception patterns within the witness's brain, and not necessarily through an actual normal physical process. And this characteristic, in its turn, is reminiscent both of neurophysiological experiments and of reports by the most reliable observers of ghosts. Although, of course, ghosts are distinguished from the class of phenomena we are studying here by the absence of material traces, which makes their interpretation a good deal simpler. And while it is probable that a complete theory of ghosts could confine the phenomena to parameters within the human nervous system, the same is not true of UFOs. For this reason, therefore, it is crucial to pursue the investigation of cases of apparitions in older times, in relation to reports such as that of the hills. The recognition of a strong psychological, or psychic, if you prefer, component in UFO manifestations makes such a study imperative. If the phenomena are to be ascribed to psychological causes, then the causes must have manifested themselves during all epochs, although naturally sociologists could give various reasons to expect a considerable increase in such manifestations since World War II. On the other hand, if the phenomenon is not wholly psychological in nature, then the discovery of historical antecedents would be a valuable clue to its nature. The experiment performed on Betty Hill by the entities is therefore quite remarkable. It will be recalled that while she was in the craft, Betty was submitted to a simulated medical test. Under hypnosis, she reported that a long needle was inserted into her navel, that she felt pain, and that the pain stopped when the leader made a certain gesture with his hand in front of her eyes. A 15th century French calendar, the Calendrier des Bergers, shows the tortures inflicted by demons on the people they have taken. The demons are depicted piercing their victims' abdomens with long needles. In fact, the psychological invariable in all these stories is unmistakable. The problem, then, is not to identify it, but to relate it in a rational manner to the physical features encountered during the observations. For example, the tracking by military radar operators of the UFO seen by the hills. Perhaps we should illustrate the difficulty of this problem by using a case that is less well known than the Hills incident, though it is quite as dramatic. It has never appeared in English UFO literature and therefore cannot have influenced American UFO lore. Even in France it is practically unknown. The incident took place on May 20, 1950, at about 4 p.m. I cannot reveal the name of the witness or the exact location. I can say, however, that the witness was a woman, and that the episode took place in the central region of France, near the Loire River. An official investigation by French local police has substantiated the physical traces mentioned in this report, which can be translated thus: I was hurrying back home to prepare dinner. I was happy and content, and I was singing some popular tune. Everything was calm and still, without any breeze or wind. I was alone on the path. Suddenly, I found myself within a brilliant, blinding light, and I saw two huge black hands appear in front of me. Each one had five fingers, of a black color with a yellowish tint, somewhat like copper. The fingers were roughly formed, slightly vibrating, or quivering. These hands did not come from behind me, but from above, as if they had been hanging over my head awaiting the proper time to catch me. The black hands did not immediately apply themselves to my head. I probably took two or three steps before they touched me. The hands had no visible arms. The two black hands were applied to my face with violence and squeezed my head, as a bird of prey rushes on its unfortunate, helpless victim. They pulled my head back against a very hard chest, one that seemed to be made of iron. I felt the cold through my hair and behind my neck, but no contact with clothes. The hands were squeezing my head like a formidable vice, not abruptly, but gradually. They were very cold, and their touch made me think that they were not made of flesh. The big fingers were placed on my eyes, and I could not see any more, on my nose so that I could not breathe, and also on my mouth, to prevent me from crying out. When I was surrounded by the strong, blinding light, I had the feeling I had been paralyzed, and when the hands touched me, I had the very distinct impression of a strong electric discharge, as if I had been shaken by a lightning bolt. My whole body was annihilated, helpless, without reflexes. I was like a broken toy between the inhuman hands of my unknown aggressor. For a little over a minute, I felt his hands tightening very strongly on either side of my throat. It was horribly painful. Then he began to swing me forward and backward several times, still fiercely squeezing my head against his chest. I had the distinct impression that this being wore armor or a steel carapace, or some very hard and cold material. I felt his two, invisible, arms pressing heavily on my shoulders. It was at that moment that I heard his laugh, a strange laugh I could not explain. It was as if I heard him through some water, and yet it seemed quite close, above my head. At first it sounded rough and hushed, then rather strong and rolling. It made me shudder and hurt me. After a few seconds the laugh stopped, suddenly cut off. Then a knee hit me in the back, hurting me very much, as if it were made of steel. That made me think my aggressor was completely covered with steel. This blow made me fall back, and the unknown aggressor made me lie down, still squeezing my head against his chest. Then he dragged me along the path, by my head, and he seemed in a great hurry. I did not hear him breathe. He pulled me into a bush full of brambles and nettles and acacias, still going backward at an incredible speed, holding my head. At that moment I heard his voice above me, and it said, "There she is. We've got her." As if he were talking to someone else, some accomplice who had stayed inside the bush, this voice, like the laugh, seemed close by, although hushed by some obstacle, and it was short, rough, sharply cut. I was choking, and I felt I was going to die. I thought of my family waiting for me at home, and my whole life passed before me in a few seconds. My aggressor pulled me through the bushes until we reached a small pasture, and suddenly he stopped. Why? Ilis hands had gradually slipped down my face, and I tried to call for help, but I had no voice left but a tiny, shrill cry. After a while I was able to sit among the brambles. I had a very hard time breathing. My bag was still in my hand, with the mummy it contained. At last I was able to get up in spite of my weakness, and then I heard some noise to my left inside the bushes. I thought I was going to see my aggressors and recognize their faces, but I saw nothing. Only the branches moved, waving in the air. I saw and heard the brambles scratching the empty space, and the grass being pressed as if under the steps of some invisible being. I was terrified. Softly, I took to the path again, walking with difficulty. My legs were lacerated by the brambles and bleeding. I felt a strange sensation of nervous exhaustion, indefinable, as if I had been electrified by a strong current. In my mouth was a sickening, metallic, bitter taste. My muscles did not obey me. Over my shoulders I felt something like a bar, and in my back a painful heat, as if I had been exposed to flames or to a burning ray. At times I still felt as if I was being brushed by an invisible brush. I must have walked like that for 5 or 6 minutes. At the end of the path there was a turn, and from there I could see houses, and then the pains decreased a little bit. Everything had lasted a quarter of an hour or 20 minutes, and it seemed that I had lived in an unreal world. Abruptly I heard a great noise, like a violent wind during a storm, a sudden displacement of warm air or a violent whirlwind. I saw the trees bending as if under a sudden storm, and I was nearly thrown down. Almost simultaneously, there was a strong, blinding white light. I had the feeling something flew through the air very fast, but I saw nothing. Soon everything became calm again. I felt discomfort and nausea. I reached the house of the lockkeeper, and when I opened the door they came toward me and asked me what had happened, because they too had seen a light from their house. The lockkeeper's wife asked me what was wrong. When I was able to speak at last, they told me all the fingers were still deeply marked in the flesh of my face, making large red bars. They applied peroxide to the scratches on my legs, and an ointment, and bathed my face with cold water. My hands were badly hurt. After a long lapse of time I started again toward to buy a few things, without saying anything to anyone, and I came back home laboriously, by another path. After I told my mother, and my father and my brother, too, what had happened to me, they filed a complaint with the gendarmerie. The police came and interviewed me at length. They examined me and observed the marks of large fingers on my face. I was still swollen, and felt pains at several places. They concluded there had been an abduction attempt and told me that it was very strange, mysterious. They took me to the spot to continue their investigation there. They noted that at some places the brambles were black and scorched, at some other places they were only pressed and flattened. The acacias too had been burned in places, and they were broken too. The fences in the pasture, which were made of wooden posts and barbed wire, had suffered also. Some posts were burned, others pulled out. The barbed wire had been wrenched away and broken. The previous day, May 19th, in the evening, the witness in this case had observed a kind of shooting star, which stopped abruptly, then appeared to go up and stay among the other stars for a while, then to grow bigger and take on a kind of swinging motion, its light alternately on and off. Suddenly it left, on a curved trajectory, and reached the horizon at very high speed. She had dismissed the incident from her mind at the time. The official investigation got nowhere and was dropped. The case is still carried as an unsolved abduction attempt. What can we say about such reports? They are neither more nor less believable than other UFO sightings. They are in line with some of the most dramatic stories of older days, which inspired the fairy tales. They are also in line, as we shall see, with the visions of the 1897 airship and the incidents that followed it. But it is too early to theorize. It is better, at this time, merely to inspect the documents, though I must confess that I have previously regarded many such cases as worthless, even if their documentation is not inferior to that of the more believable cases we study. Take another abduction case, one that allegedly occurred on August 21, 1915, Gallipoli, August 28, 1915. The following is an account of a strange incident that happened. In the morning, during the severest and final days of the fighting, which took place at Hill 60, Sivla Bay, Anzac, Australian and New Zealand Army Corps. The day broke clear, without a cloud in sight, as any beautiful Mediterranean day could be expected to be. The exception, however, was a number of perhaps 6 or 8 loaf of bread-shaped clouds, all shaped exactly alike, which were hovering over Hill 60.